leave. She did get back to us, though, and Jody was allowed to go to the school daycare, but I wouldn't let her. We were not going to be exceptions. We survived that year without anybody's help, and I was proud of us. Amber passed ninth grade. Jody started talking again. I paid our bills. At our lowest moments, I got my strength from concentrating on the anger and terror I had felt coming back from the bank when I realized we had been forgotten. Forgotten, but not alone. I knew there were a ton of kids like us out there who had gone through the same thing. 80% of the women serving time for murder in mom's prison had killed a husband or live-in boyfriend. I mentioned that statistic to Betty once. I said that really told you something about women. And she said, no, it told you something about men. Watching the turkeys in the sky made me drowsy. I couldn't remember what day it was or if I had to work, but I didn't care. I had to get some sleep. I got up from the grass and turned toward the house and froze in my tracks. Misty was on the front porch with the Ruger aimed at my head. I screamed and dove for the ground. 30 turkeys broke and ran for cover, gobbling and clucking. "Why'd you do that?" Misty shouted. "What are you doing with my gun?" I cried. "I was going to shoot a couple turkeys." "Jesus." I got shakily to my feet. My forehead had broken out in a sweat. I walked over to her. "Don't ever do that," I said, taking the gun roughly from her hands. "I figured you'd be happy about it," she said. "Free food." She had already attacked her young freckles with two bold strokes of purple shadow like a slash and burn farmer. "Why are you looking at me like that?" she asked. "Like what?" "Like you're surprised to see me?" "Sometimes I forget you're just a kid." "No, I'm not," she replied. "I started my period." "Don't tell me that," I winced. I followed her eyes. They were looking at the rock I must have hit the night before. It had four perfectly round, blood-brown spots on it. "Don't call me a kid," she said. I gingerly touched my lower lip. I'd washed my face off in Callie's creek, but I hadn't been able to find my reflection. The lip was probably cracked and swollen. It still hurt like hell. "I was just thinking, I want you to go to college and get a good job when you grow up," I said, without knowing where the thought had come from. "College?" she laughed. "I can't even go to the Lickin' Putt." "I just mean, I don't want you to work at ShopRite. You can do whatever you want." She gave me a quick, dark glance. "No, I can't." "Yes, you can. You have to be smart to go to college." "No, you don't." "You have to be rich." "No, you don't." "You have to be something," she persisted in her determinedly empty voice. "I'm not anything," she added so low I had to lean over to hear it. "That's not true," I said. "Okay," she sighed, openly appeasing me. "You know what I am?" "What?" "A good shot." I looked down at her. She looked back with a challenge in her eyes. "That's something," I said. "That doesn't count with anyone, except Dad." I didn't know what to say. Misty never talked about Dad, even though we all knew his death had left a bigger hole in her life than it had in any of ours. "It's kind of like the way you don't count with anyone except Amber," she further explained when I didn't respond. "Huh?" Her lips twitched into something like a smile, then went back to normal again. She turned her back on me and walked away. She was done talking. Getting her to start again would be like prying open ancient cathedral doors. I left her there on the porch, fiddling absent-mindedly with her collar. She stared across the yard that had become sprinkled with small yellow flowers overnight, past the ginger-brown road and the green hump of clearing to the blue-gray smudge of hills against a pink sky. But I knew all she saw was a failed kill. I went straight to the basement, hoping for sleep. I set my gun back in its corner and walked over to my bed, took off my clothes, and lay down. I didn't want to get under the covers, but the room was about 10 degrees cooler than outside. I went and got Dad's coat off the back of my desk chair. Skip's letter was sitting on the desk. I finally had something to write back to him about. Dear Skip, what's new with you? I nailed Mrs. Mercer. He would have shit reading that. He wouldn't have believed me, though. I couldn't blame him. But I did nail her. With all my might. If she had been a board, she would have cracked down the middle. I got an instant hard-on thinking about it. Not a nice one I could dispose of at my leisure with the ladies of Victoria's Secret. An urgent one. A maddening one like a bad itch. I had never been good at not scratching. I used to scratch mosquito bites until they bled. Sometimes Mom would see me and blame the blood on Dad, and I would let her, not because I wanted her sympathy or because I wanted Dad to get in trouble, but because when they figured out I had been lying, they were united in their anger toward me. I wanted to beat off until I bled, but even then I knew I wouldn't get the relief I craved. A hand wasn't going to do it for me anymore. Friction wasn't going to be enough. My dick had been enlightened, too. Peaches again. An overripe peach before it started to rot. That's what she felt like inside. I went back to bed and stared at the white circle of my light bulb and thought about her ass in a white t-shirt growing dimmer and dimmer in the black night as she walked away from me. I didn't know if she had enjoyed it. I'd been too preoccupied with what was in my hands and between my lips to pay much attention to her as a whole. Even if I had paid attention, I'm not sure I would have known what to look for. I once overheard my cousin Mike talking to a buddy about his latest girlfriend. He said they had to be real careful fooling around if there was anyone else in the house because she was a screamer. The way they both grinned when he said it, I could tell they thought this was great. I suppose it was if, while you were having sex with someone, you wanted to think you were killing her too. Screaming would have made me a nervous wreck. I didn't want a screamer. I didn't want someone to talk dirty either. I wanted someone who would look at me. At least, that's what I always thought. Then, when I got to be with a woman, I couldn't look at her. Seeing her eyes, like saying her name, would have been unbearably human while I was pumping away at her like an animal. I didn't know what I was going to do if it turned out she left because I wasn't good enough. I wouldn't be surprised. I wasn't good at anything. But knowing there was something wrong with you didn't make it any easier to accept, even if you knew it your whole life. Fat people never grew fond of their fat. Poor people never felt good about their crappy houses. I went ahead and jerked off anyway. The TV was going full blast and Amber's radio was blaring when I woke up. I spent as little time as possible in the kitchen finding something to eat. There were two pieces of leftover frozen pizza sitting on the stove. I scarfed them down and grabbed the last Mountain Dew. I slipped out the back door. The day had turned out as nice as the morning. Not too hot, not too cool. Blue sky and fluffy white clouds. Bank calendar weather. I walked around front and surveyed the place. It wasn't a bad house as cheap little prefab vinyl-sided shitboxes went. The original house was kind of cute. Gray with brick red shutters and a front porch Dad had built for Mom as a first anniversary present, with white wooden railings and green shingles on the roof. When Mom got pregnant with Misty, they decided to build on another bedroom. Mom had been promising me one anyway, because Amber and I were getting too old to share a room, and I was too young for them to already be thinking about kicking me into the basement. Dad and Uncle Mike and Uncle Jim decided to do it on their own. Between the three of them, they had the know-how and the tools. What they lacked was an attention span. They were like kids together, shaking up their beer cans and squirting each other, having belching contests, quitting in the middle to go fishing or watch a Pirates game. It took them 2 years to finish it. The first winter, they covered the insulation with plastic sheeting. The next winter, with fiberglass. Dad finally got a deal on some used siding he couldn't pass up. It was brown, but he promised Mom he would paint the whole house the same color someday. He never did. My folks gave me the room on my 9th birthday. Mom stretched a big red ribbon across the doorway and had me cut it with a pair of scissors like it was the grand opening of a new county dump. My bed was already in it, made up with a new set of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle sheets. Dad had sacrificed the chest of drawers he used in the shed for his odds and ends crap, and Mom had fixed it up and painted it green to match the turtles. On top of it stood the pencil holder Amber had made for me out of a soup can, construction paper, and glitter. They all stood there waiting, Dad with his hand resting on Mom's shoulder, baby Misty on Mom's hip, Amber grinning from ear to ear in her pink ballerina Halloween costume she had insisted on wearing to my birthday dinner. I could see chocolate cake crumbs caught in the tutu netting. They were expecting me to be thrilled, even though they knew I wanted to stretch Armstrong in a grave robber, a remote control monster truck from Radio Shack. My eyes filled with tears. It wasn't that I didn't want the room, I did. It's that I thought the room was owed to me. I was too stunned to speak at first, but I finally found my voice and shouted something about every kid in America getting the grave robber for Christmas except for me, and how this was the worst birthday any kid ever had. I didn't care that I was going to get the shit kicked out of me for doing it. I tore out of the house, ran across the road, through the clearing, and into the first belt of trees. To my surprise, Dad followed hot on my heels. He wasn't a chaser by nature. If he didn't catch you on his first couple lunges, he settled back into the camouflage of his couch like a big cat, lowering himself into the high grasses of a savanna, and he waited for you to forget. And I wasn't a runner. I always stayed and took my punishments because I liked getting them over with, and because it was easier to withstand a beating when you weren't winded. This time was different, though, and we both knew it. I wasn't running away from Dad, I was running away from my life, and Dad was chasing me because I had felt the need to. I did a good job of staying ahead of him until I suddenly conveniently tripped over my own feet like some idiot in a horror film. Dad caught me easily by the arm and threw a roundhouse punch which missed my face but hit me square in the chest and knocked me on my butt. I landed on a bed of blacklick, which the natural salt licks are called around here because they're tainted black by the coal in the ground. I looked down and saw the dark salt showing through in a big patch like a dried up scab on the hillside. I used to wonder if the black licks were safe for the deer, since there was so much coal in them. I used to feel sorry for them because they were dumb animals until I came to realize instinct would always drag them back, even if they were smart enough to understand that what they were doing was slowly killing them. Dad pulled me up and hit me once more. I knew he was going to have to do it. I knew he needed to hit me in the face successfully before he could relax, since that had been his original intention. I didn't take it personally. I wasn't his son or even a person at that point. I was a task. Then he grabbed me by the arm and escorted me home. He opened the door of the truck and pushed me inside. I sat perfectly still except for the violent shaking going on inside me. Mom came out on the porch and started screaming at him. They yelled back and forth for a couple of minutes. None of it was about me. Mom went on about how hard she had worked on my dresser, and Dad shouted back that he was the one who built the whole fucking room, and if she wanted to live in a goddamn palace, she should have never married him in the first place. Then Mom started screaming about how the ice cream was melting and the cake was drying out. Amber was hiding somewhere, because she didn't have any courage left, but she would crawl into bed with me that night to make up for it. I didn't like it when she slept with me because Dad had hit her, but I didn't mind it when it was because Dad had hit me. Dad ended his side of the argument suddenly and slammed into the truck. Mom looked scared as we drove away. I remembered calmly thinking, Dad's going to drive me down a back road and kill me and bury me in the woods. The idea didn't shock me, and the fact that it didn't depressed me even more than my shitty birthday or the thought of dying. He didn't say a word during the drive. He didn't seem to notice his surroundings at all until we rounded a bend in the road. And off to one side was a small city of rust-streaked iron-gray buildings, standing grim and empty in the middle of 10 contaminated acres. A chain-link fence ran for a mile along the road, posted with bright orange hazard signs and bright yellow no trespassing signs, all of them shot full of bullet holes. "The Carbonville Mine, water reclamation plant," he announced, his voice making me jump after the silence. I knew about it, of course. Everybody did. It had been designed to treat the acid mine water coming from the abandoned No. 9 J&P complex nearby and make it safe for human consumption again. I knew all about No. 9, too. It was the first mine Grandpa worked in, and he brought it up a lot, talking about its tunnels like they belonged to a woman. The plant only served its original purpose for about a year before something went wrong and the DER shut it down. But its remains had lived on for another 25, as a monument to the folly of trying to clean up a region that was poisoned from the inside. Dad pulled the truck off the road and parked by the fence. He got out and started walking. I automatically followed. He stopped when we came within a view of a couple dozen small, gray, insole brick houses scattered along the outside of the chain link, like the plant had shook and showered its perimeter with tiny replicas of failure. Dad squatted down so he was lower than me and pointed at one or all of them.
"That's where I grew up," he said.
I glanced at him to make sure he was being serious. I had always assumed he grew up in the house where my grandparents lived now. It wasn't anything to get excited about, but at least it was a decent size and completely nailed together. I couldn't read his expression at first.
I expected him to be torn up or pissed, or he could have been happy.
One of those ass-backwards people like Grandpa who only felt fondness for terrible places and bitched like hell if he had to go on a picnic. But I didn't see bitterness or self-pity or some warped, nostalgic wistfulness in his face. What I saw was something like pride, but pride without ego. Something like acceptance, but acceptance without ever being allowed to consider any other options. I didn't figure it out until I was back home, lying on my sore butt, on my new sheets in my new room, feeling the familiar ache spread through my chest and face where Dad had hit me. That what I had seen was a gracious loser. That was the year birthdays stopped being about cake and presents for me and started being about survival. Dad started another addition about 4 years ago after he got it into his head that he needed his own TV room away from us kids. He and Uncle Mike never finished that one at all. Eventually, they built a new wall to replace the one they had ripped out and left the wood frame hanging off the side of the house and a couple rolls of pink insulation in the yard. I pulled the thing down about a month after Mom shot him and sold the lumber. Uncle Mike was right. The eaves and the trim needed painting. The wood around the windows was starting to rot. I noticed two shingles missing from the roof. Even from the ground, I could see clumps of wet leaves sticking out of the gutters. And I had to do something about that piece of pipe. I saw Jody sitting on the front porch steps writing in her notebook. Sparkle Three Horn and Yellowy the Yellow Helmet Head, I had bought her to keep her mouth shut, sat on either side of her. She looked up at me, looking at the house. "What are you doing?" she asked me.
"Making a list," I said. "What are you doing?"
"I'm making a list," she answered emphatically. "You don't have any paper."
"I'm making one in my head," I explained. "Can I see yours?"
She held it out to me. "Feed dinosaurs, clean my side of room, fold laundry, mow yard." I gave it back to her, smiling.
"I went to school with a mow yard," I said.
"What?" "Never mind, it was a joke." "Fangs a lot was a better one," she said. "I agree." I sat down next to her on the steps. "What happened to your lip? It's all puffy."
"Nothing," I brushed her off.
"Since when do you mow the yard?" I asked. She drew a heart on her list. "Last night, Amber told us you were upset because Uncle Mike said you need to mow the yard and do a bunch of other stuff, and that's why you drank beers and went for a walk with Elvis. I thought I could help out." She paused and drew a couple more hearts. "Why do you and Amber fight all the time?"
"You heard us fighting?" She nodded. "What did you hear?"
"Amber screaming swear words, mostly."
"Yeah, well," I started. "Just ignore that stuff."
"I guess it's not so bad," she said. "Esme says it's unhealthy to bottle up emotions. She says it's good to get your feelings out in the open."
"Is there anything Esme Mercer doesn't know?"
"She doesn't know who Confucius is."
"Confucius?"
I gave her a look out of the corner of my eye.
"You know who he is?"
"He's the guy who writes the fortunes," she answered, nodding.
I laughed. "Who told you that?"
"Mommy."
I swallowed my smile. She watched me patiently, waiting to see if I was going to dispute Mom's facts. I flaked a couple pieces of paint off the step with a fingernail.
"Esme says her mom and dad fight all the time," Jody went on. "And when she asks her mom about it, her mom tells her it's better for parents to fight than keep it bottled up."
"Her parents fight a lot?" I asked. I guess so. Her mom screams at her, and Zach too, and then she hugs them and cries and says she's sorry. I've seen her do it. She glanced up at me to make sure I was paying attention.
Esme's mom is nice and pretty, and she can still do cartwheels, but...
You've seen her do a cartwheel? I interrupted. Yeah? She kept studying my face. I tried to keep it composed. She'd do one for you, I bet, she said. That's okay. Anyway, she went on, hunching up her little shoulders beneath her faded rodeo Minnie Mouse shirt. I think she's nuts. She's not nuts, I explained. All parents have to yell at their kids sometimes. Why? 'Cause they do bad things and 'cause they drive them crazy. Do we drive you crazy? Yeah. You hardly ever yell at us. I'm one of those unhealthy people. Oh. So why does she cry and say she's sorry later? She asked. She probably feels bad because she loves her kids and doesn't like yelling at them, so she apologizes. Daddy never apologized to us for hitting us. Does that mean he didn't love us? Dad loved us. Mommy never apologized for shooting him. Jody, I said quickly and stood up to leave.
I got a lot of work to do today.
Does Mommy love us?
I closed my eyes, wishing with all my might that she'd disappear, along with the house and the guilty joy I felt knowing Esme's parents fought all the time.
Doesn't Mom tell you she loves you every time you see her? I asked her slowly. Actions speak louder than words, she announced. I read that in one of my fortunes. I can go get it for you. No, I said. I believe you. I walked away from her and our conversation and felt instant relief. 2 years ago, before I knew any better, if someone had given me a list of all the things I was going to have to do for Jody and asked me to pick the hardest one, I probably would have picked clean up her puke when she gets sick in the middle of the night. If they had asked me to pick the most important one, I would have picked put food on the table. Now I would answer both of them the same way. Talk to her. I headed for Dad's shed, trying to decide if I wanted to mow or scrape first, when I noticed Elvis off to the side of the yard with something clamped in his jaws, shaking his head wildly from side to side. One of the girls had unchained him. I ran across the yard to Rocky's grave, but before I even got there, I saw the empty hole. Shit, I said, and took off after Elvis. He saw me coming and thought we were playing a game. He went tearing into the woods. I gave him a good chase, but I had to stop and catch my breath after a while. I sat down and leaned back against a tree trunk. Elvis suddenly burst from the undergrowth in front of me, his tail wagging, wondering why I had given up so soon. Something dangled from his mouth, but it wasn't a groundhog. Up close, it looked like a crusty old rag. Come here, stupid, I said, and made a soft whistle between my teeth. You're not in trouble. He watched me skeptically for a moment, the tail stopping in mid-wag. Come here, I said again. He made one more playful lunge. When I didn't respond, he came trotting over and shoved his face in mine. He dropped the rag in my lap and gave me a couple licks. I picked the thing up. It wasn't a rag. It was a girl's shirt, a red one, with a big sunflower in the middle, covered with a big brown stain. Stiff and mud-encrusted like it had been out here for a long time. I scraped off some of the dirt and smoothed it out a little. It looked familiar, but it looked too big to be Jody's and too small to be Misty's. The stain was huge. It could have been chocolate or paint, but I knew blood when I saw it.
Chapter 10 I waited a couple of days before asking anyone about the shirt. I didn't know why. There wasn't anything terrible about me finding a little girl's blood-stained shirt in the woods, as long as I didn't find a blood-stained little girl, too. I asked Jody about it first, since she wouldn't ask me why I was asking. She told me she never had a sunflower shirt, but she used to have a pair of pink overalls with daisies on them. I asked Amber next. She did most of the laundry and all of the patching, mending, hemming, and unhemming. A lot of Misty's and Jody's clothes were hand-me-downs from her. And she never forgot an outfit, and how it made someone look. Too fat, too geeky, too 70s, 280s. Too obvious. The moment I mentioned a sunflower shirt, she perked up. Things had been pretty tense between us since Saturday night. We hadn't talked much, but clothing was a topic she couldn't resist. Of course we had a sunflower shirt, she told me. How could I forget it? It was hers. It came with red and white checked bike shorts. She never wore it much, too hillbilly. But she gave it to Misty, and Misty wore it for a while. Not the shorts. She thought they made her look fat. Come to think of it, she hadn't seen that shirt in years. Misty would have outgrown it by now, but Jody might want it. Did I know where it was? What did I care about a sunflower shirt anyway? I started to tell her the truth, that Elvis had dug it up in the woods and it had blood all over it. But I changed my mind. Amber didn't deal well with blood. She used to faint at nosebleeds. I told her I had a dream about it instead. She narrowed her eyes at me in disgust, but she bought the explanation. It was easy to accept coming from her brother, the loser headcase. My next step should have been talking to Misty, but I never got around to it. The shirt bothered me, though. I wasn't sure why. During Amber's Wednesday night dinner, I finally came up with an explanation. A bunch of Misty's sloppy Joe fell out of the bun and got all over her shirt. Amber freaked and started ranting about how hard it was to get greasy ketchup out of clothes and how Misty couldn't afford to ruin a perfectly good shirt because God only knew when she'd be able to get any new clothes. She sounded just like Mom, except Mom would have said it calmly. Dad would have smacked her. Not hard. He never smacked hard in front of Mom or at the dinner table. He would have reached out and cuffed her on the side of the head just enough to make her teeth click together and her ears ring for a second or two. I remember Dad popping her in the mouth once, and Misty watching silently as penny-sized drops of black blood fell from her split lip and soaked into her new jeans. She hid those jeans from Mom to protect him. She threw them in the garbage can, not the best of hiding places, but she was only 5 or 6. Mom found them, of course, and she and Dad had a big fight. Misty had probably hidden the sunflower shirt, too. The explanation made sense. But it gave me the creeps thinking about what he must have done to her to make her bleed that much. Betty would have told me to ask her. She would have told me to ask Jody what she saw the night Mom shot Dad, and to ask Amber why she hated me so much. She would have told me to drive over to Callie Mercer's house and burst in on the amazing dinner she'd be serving to her banker husband and her perfect kids on her glass-topped table on her polished stone floor, and ask her why she fucked me. She was always telling me to ask Mom why she did it. I could never have closure until I got the answers. All week long, I worked 8-hour days at Barclays, came home, asked if I got any phone calls, ate dinner, scraped trim for a half hour, asked if I got any phone calls, drove to ShopRite, worked till midnight, came home and woke Jody to see if I got any phone calls. I told myself I wasn't being unreasonable. Callie could have called me if she wanted to. We knew each other. We were neighbors. Our kids played together. They rode the same bus. There were all sorts of excuses she could make. She could have come up to the house with another book or a recipe. I wasn't completely without an ego, though. Once I got through the first 5 or 6 hours Saturday and I hadn't heard from her, I started to worry maybe someone or something was keeping her from me. Maybe her husband had found out. Maybe their house had burned down. Maybe she had hit her head and had amnesia. Maybe there had been a family emergency. Maybe she had been attacked by a rabid skunk. But as the week dragged on, I knew none of those things had happened because I questioned Jody every night at dinner and found out that Esme's mom put Esme on the bus every morning and met her at the bus every afternoon, and she looked happy and healthy. I did my best to get Jody to go play at Esme's house or invite Esme to ours, but for the first time in the history of their friendship, Esme was booked solid for a whole week. She had a dentist appointment on Monday, her dance class on Tuesday, a brownie meeting on Wednesday, and plans to play at Cruz Battellini's house on Thursday. I finally decided Callie Mercer thought I was a joke. I couldn't sleep at all Thursday night. I gave up and went upstairs around 5 a.m. and sat at the kitchen table staring at the phone. I knew she would still be asleep. I closed my eyes and made myself dizzy thinking about her stretched out naked in bed and me lying beside her. I knew what she felt like now. That was the worst part. Even if I could get her out of my mind, I couldn't get her off my fingers. I sat there for about an hour until I heard the girls opening and closing dresser drawers and the bathroom sink running. I went out the back door with Elvis at my heels and started walking. I stayed on Potshot Road for a while, then turned off into the woods. The morning was cool and misty, and the woods were thick with wet spring undergrowth. Briars tore at my jeans, and low branches swatted at my face, but I still went at a pretty good pace. It took me longer than I thought to cover the 3 miles to the Mercer house. I came out on the bank across the road just as Brad Mercer's Jeep pulled out of their driveway. The bank was a steep one, more of a hill. Elvis and I took a seat on the damp ground back in the trees. We were about 20 feet above the road with a good view of the back of the Mercer house and their driveway curving around to the front. The bus stopped at the end of it to pick up Esme before going on to pick up Jody at the bottom of our road. I waited and watched, holding tightly to Elvis's collar so he couldn't bolt and give away our position. Esme came down the drive first, slipping her arms into her backpack. Zach ran after her, clutching a juice box in one hand. Callie came next, walking slowly so she could sip at the steaming mug of coffee she had cupped in both hands. She was wearing shorts even though it was still chilly, and she had on a big gray sweatshirt. She called out to the kids to stay away from the road. I heard her voice clear as a bell. She didn't look or act any different. Esme lectured her about something, and she shook her head at her. She smiled at Zach when he brought her a handful of gravel. She turned her back on them for a moment and looked at her hills while she drank her coffee. The bus came rumbling up the road and groaned to a stop below me, temporarily blocking my view. When it pulled away again, Esme was gone, and Callie and Zach were waving. She reached down a hand for Zach. He took it, and they walked back down the drive. I stood up. My jeans were soaked from sitting on the ground for so long and from tromping through the wet woods. I stared at her, willing her to turn around and see me, to look at me with pity or ridicule or indifference, but to at least look at me. I was beginning to think I had imagined everything. I ended up getting to Barclays an hour and a half late and got chewed out royally for it. I had to stay and work an extra hour to make up for it, so I didn't have time to drive home for dinner. Friday night was Jody's other night, scrambled eggs and Bacos. I got to ShopRite starving and dead tired. I bought 2 Milky Ways and popped a couple of no-doze tablets from the box I had ripped off the other night. It was the first thing I had ever stolen. I was planning on buying them until I saw the price. Rick was usually long gone by the time my shift started, but tonight I saw his fat face behind the glass of his manager's cubicle. He always stayed inside when he talked to one of us. Up there, no one could tell he was short and fat and useless. He was an all-powerful head like the Wizard of Oz. He motioned me over. I was sure he had found out about the pills and he was going to fire me. I didn't get upset. I felt kind of relieved. We couldn't survive on the shit wages I made at Barclays. I wouldn't be able to get another job because Rick would tell everyone I was a shoplifter. We would have to go on welfare. I could sit back and let the government take care of us, or the girls would go to foster homes, and I would only have to take care of myself.
I had a complaint about you,
he said, without looking up from the papers he was pointlessly shuffling. Here it comes, I thought. As soon as the girls found homes, I was going to hit the road with Elvis. We could go anywhere. I'd start by visiting Skip, then maybe my cousin Mike. That would be worth it just to see the look on his face when I showed up at his jock fraternity.
A customer complained you packed a hair care product in the same bag with produce.
Huh?
You heard me, and you didn't put it in a separate plastic bag before you put it in a regular bag.
Am I fired? I said.
Christ, Altmer, could you be any stupider?
He sneered.
No, you're not fired, just don't do it again. And one other thing.
He stopped me before I could walk away.
There's some shelving sitting on the left-hand side when you walk in the storeroom door. I want you to set it up at the end of the cereal aisle and stock it with bananas.
Bananas?
He blew out his nose in annoyance. Some people want bananas to go with their cereal, and this way they don't have to walk the whole way to the produce if that's the only item from produce they want. Or maybe they weren't planning on buying bananas at all, but seeing them next to the cereal reminds them they like them sliced up on their cornflakes, so they buy them. Understand?
Should I set up a shelf of celery next to the peanut butter, too? He gave me a flat stare.
They do it at the buy low, and they sell a lot of bananas.
Okay, I said. I walked back to the cashiers. Church was busy bagging and talking to a woman about the superiority of Heinz pickles over Claussen. Not only were they cheaper, but you didn't have to rush them home to the refrigerator. You could put them in a cupboard and keep them there for months. He knew because his mom did it all the time. They had jars of pickles in their cupboards from last Thanksgiving. He wasn't kidding. When I passed by him, he fixed me with a serious look.
Something wrong, Church?
What did the boss want?
He asked. He wants me to put bananas in the cereal aisle? Before the words were out of my mouth, I regretted them. Church's jaw dropped open. He set down the jar of spaghetti sauce he was about to bag and started shaking his head.
Why would he do something like that?
People like to eat them on their cereal, I answered him. Rick thinks it'll make money. Church dropped his stare to his hands and concentrated.
It's wrong, he said. Bananas can't go with cereal.
Don't let it bother you, Bud said from his register. Sometimes it makes more sense to think about what something's used for instead of what it is.
No,
Church insisted.
Think about people, for instance, Bud continued. If we divided up people by what they were instead of what they did, none of us would be working together. I'd be stuck with a bunch of old fogies, and Harley'd be working with the other boys. He'd have to get his head shaved and start wearing an earring.
He winked at me.
No,
Church said again.
There's nice people and mean people, and that's all. Right, Harley?
Sure, I guess so.
He wandered slowly away from his station, with his skinny arms pressed to his sides and his skinny shoulders hunched forward looking like a closed umbrella, and sat down on his bench.
Bud finished with his customer and started bagging for him. He didn't look like he was ever coming back. I tried to slip away unnoticed, but Church spotted me.
Don't do it, Harley, he shouted after me. It's wrong, I'm telling you.
I took my good old time putting the shelves up. They were cheap metal crap with about 100 screws. I kept getting distracted thinking about Church and how I was violating his world order, and Rick and how I was doing his bidding, and all the boxes of Pop-Tarts and granola bars sitting a few feet away from me, and how I'd kill for just one. When I finished, I wanted to tear the whole thing down. I crouched down to pick up my screwdriver off the floor and heard a female voice from the next aisle over.
I said if you were good, you could pick out one snack.
But Mom, that's not fair,
Esme explained.
Every snack I pick, Zach likes two, so he actually gets two snacks. But he always picks Doritos, and I hate Doritos, so I only get one.
Life isn't always fair, Callie growled. I couldn't believe I had forgotten she did her grocery shopping on Friday nights. This was a perfect opportunity. I could see her, but she had her kids with her, so it would be safe. I could make polite small talk with her. I'd be obligated. She was a customer. And if she gave me one of her honey-dipped smiles, I'd know I might still have a chance. But if she looked at me like a school budget cut, I wouldn't know what to do. I stood up and turned around so fast I fell into the Wheaties and knocked a couple boxes on the floor. I put them back and raced to the opposite end of the aisle and waited there until I was sure she wasn't coming toward me. Then I jogged to the front of the store, grabbed the orange reflective vest off its hook near the magazines, and headed for the door.
Did you do it, Harley?
Church cried after me. Once I got outside, I stopped to catch my breath. There weren't many carts to bring in. I gathered up the few strays and took a seat on the cart return's metal railing to try and calm my gut. I felt like I was going to puke. I probably wasn't supposed to take those pills on an empty stomach. The sun had just gone down. The sky was gray, tinged with blue. Across the road, the hills beyond the car wash looked even bluer. They rolled away from me like an ocean's waves, but without the violent motion.
Technically, they were mountains, part of the Allegheny foothills, but mountain was too colossal a word for them, and foothills was too humble.
Hills, on its own, sounded solid and comforting, which is what they were most of the time. Laurel Falls was a nice enough town.
named after pink flowers and crystal waterfalls, sitting at the bottom of a small cup of a valley. It was the county seat, so it had its own fairgrounds and an old-fashioned red brick courthouse with big white pillars and a gold clock tower. It had a hospital, two malls, a drive-in, the new Super Walmart, a YMCA, and a Planned Parenthood clinic that was always hopping. But it was too big. 8,000 people last census. I didn't mind working here, but I was glad I lived in Blacklick, which was a town named after a poisoned chunk of salt. Population 118. Me and the girls were 3% of our town. We were almost significant. A woman pulled in and parked her car and gave me a dirty look on her way into the store. She was probably going to complain I was a loafer. I didn't care. I would have sat there all night, except while I was doing it, I forgot the reason why I was out there in the first place, until it was too late and Kelly Mercer came wheeling her cart toward me. Esme saw me before I could do anything about it. "It's Jody's brother," she announced, beaming at me and giving a royal wave. "Hi, Harley. Hi, it's me, Esme."
"Hi, Harley," Zach chimed in. "It's me, too."
Callie came to an abrupt stop in the middle of the lot when she saw me. Zach went lurching forward in the car seat, then snapped back. A roll of paper towels tumbled out onto the blacktop. She bent down and picked up the paper towels.
"I wondered where you were," she said to my feet as I came up next to her. "I mean, I know you work here, but I didn't see you. Not that I was looking for you."
She wedged the paper towels back in the cart.
"Not that I wasn't looking for you either. I mean, if I had seen you, I wouldn't have minded seeing you."
She straightened up and pushed her hair away from her face. She finally looked at me, and I looked at her. I imagined what it would have felt like to look in her eyes when I was inside her. I started thinking about Amber fucking that boy on the couch, and how he hadn't been looking at her. I wondered if she had been looking at him. I went back to that night in my mind, and instead of lowering my gun and going outside, I blew his head off. It exploded like an overripe pumpkin, but it didn't stop him. His body kept pumping away at Amber. The stump between his shoulders jerked back and forth, sending blood spraying everywhere. Then he shuddered and collapsed from coming, or dying, or both. Amber pushed him off her and rose up from the couch naked, spattered in his blood and brains, and she thanked me.
"Do you need help with your groceries?" I asked Callie.
"You don't have to do that," she said.
I glanced down at my orange vest. "It's kind of my job," I said.
"Oh, right."
She made an embarrassed laugh.
"Sure, thanks."
I started loading bags in her trunk while she leaned into the car to buckle Zach in his seat. I watched and put a bag heavy with canned goods on top of her loaf of bread.
"Is Jody at home?"
Esme asked me.
"Huh?"
I said.
"Is Jody at home?"
she repeated firmly.
"Sure."
"Mom," she called out, "can I play with Jody when we get home?"
"It's almost 9 o'clock,
Callie responded with her head still stuck inside the car.
"You're going straight to bed when we get home.
Brad had this business dinner tonight down in Latrobe," she started explaining to me after she finished with Zach. "And tomorrow he has a golf game with the same people, so he's just staying there. I forgot about it, so I didn't have anyone to stay with the kids." Her voice trailed off.
"I'm sorry, you don't care about any of this."
I finished loading and closed the trunk lid. Callie walked over and stood next to me and stared at her rear bumper. Her forehead was creased with concern. I knew what she was going to say to me.
"I wish I could be most guys. I wished I could just come out and ask her if she wanted to have sex with me again. And if she said no, I would figure it was because there was something wrong with her, and I wouldn't let it bother me. Or I wished I could have kissed her. I never got around to kissing her mouth.
I was pretty sure I was a terrible kisser, so I wished I could kiss her like most guys, and when I stopped, she'd be wet and pliable. But I wasn't most guys, and she wasn't the Virgin Mary. She wasn't a ruthless whore either. She didn't want to hurt me, but she couldn't fix me either. It was too big of a job. I think I scared her."
"Harley," she started. I didn't want to hear it. I couldn't stand to hear it. I really liked that artist Francis Bacon, I blurted out. Her forehead smoothed out again, except for two faint lines that were permanent. She gave me a silky smile, my ace in the hole. Every woman had her weakness. My mom's was Valley Dairy's maple walnut ice cream. Whenever Dad brought her some home for no reason, he was golden for days.
You liked Figure with Meat? She asked a little uncertainly.
That's the one with the Pope sitting between two bloody sides of beef, right? Yeah, I liked it.
Huh, she said. Did you read the description?
Sure.
Which explanation do you believe? That the artist was saying the Pope is a butcher, or that he was saying he's as much a victim as the slaughtered animal behind him?
I thought the Pope was laughing.
Laughing? She said, startled.
She slipped her hands into her jeans pockets. I watched them go, remembering how they had given me gently brutal strokes.
She leaned back against the trunk.
He did a series of paintings around the same time of screaming figures wearing business suits. Some critics say he was trying to show the anguish experienced by people in authoritarian roles. I think he was saying they're evil.
Maybe they were dancing, I tried.
Maybe, she said, smiling and nodding.
Is he dead? I asked.
Who, Francis Bacon?
Yeah.
Mom! Zach shouted. Esme's touching my car seat! I think he passed away in 91 or 92.
Good.
Good?
She laughed. I want to put him on my list of dead people I'd like to meet.
Do you have a list of living people you'd like to meet?
I shook my head. I figure I have a better chance of meeting people I'd like when I'm dead. She laughed again. I was being serious.
Is it a big list?
I shook my head. I'm just starting it.
Mom!
Esme stuck her head out the back car window.
He's singing the Barney song. Make him stop.
Esme's shrill words affected Callie like a whip cracked behind her. She jumped around and rushed at the window, and Esme's head instantly disappeared. Callie's head followed, and a heated buzz came from the car. Then she walked back to me, smiling calmly, and announced, I have to go.
Sure.
No, wait, she said suddenly. She took a deep breath with her whole body the way kids do, and began an earnest discussion with herself.
I want to apologize to you for the way I left. For everything, really. Not to imply that it wasn't wonderful, but I'm not sure it should have happened. Actually, I know it shouldn't have happened. I feel like I took advantage, but I wanted to help. You were so upset. Of course, there are better ways to help a person. Or maybe not. I guess I wasn't thinking too clearly.
The only word I heard was wonderful. It was a word to describe tea parties. When I thought of our night together, I pictured fire-ravaged buildings.
It's okay, I told her.
No, it's not. She brought a hand to her forehead with a worn-out air.
I tried waking you, and I couldn't. You actually had me worried there for a minute or two.
I thought maybe something had happened. Kids have heart attacks, too. Then I realized you were just sound asleep.
I know that's no excuse for leaving you there, outside, alone, at night.
She laid each word down, then paused and considered them like a card hand, before carefully adding, in the mud, and near the water.
It was a terrible thing to do, she finished.
It's okay, I said again.
It's just that,
she hadn't finished.
While I was waiting for you to wake up, I started thinking about all the awful things you might think about me.
What things?
My God, Harley, I'm married with two little kids.
She said it with a fearful awe, like it was a rare medical condition.
I couldn't stand the thought of you thinking I'm some pathetic, bored housewife on the prowl for boys to corrupt.
Corrupt. It appeared one neon letter at a time across the trunk lid. Once it was all there, I stared at it for a moment, letting it burn into my brain. Then I snuffed it out with a blink of my eyes.
And I'm so much older than you. Do you know how old I am?
28, I guessed.
I'm 33,
she corrected me simply.
I was glad to see she wasn't one of those women who turned into a gushing, giggling mess because some guy told her she looked younger than she really was. I hated that.
Amber thought you were over 30, I said. She raised her eyebrows.
Oh, she did?
I don't want to hurt your feelings, I said, changing the topic from Amber. But when I think about you, I don't think about personal shit like you being married or having kids or how old you are.
What do you think about?
You really want to know?
Yes.
Zach started wailing.
Your butt, mostly.
My butt?
She repeated, her lips melting into another smile.
Do you think about my butt a lot?
Define a lot.
Once a day?
Yes. The car started rocking. Through the rear window, I could see stuffed animals and small hands and feet flying around.
Look, Harley, she said in an aggravated rush. This obviously isn't a good time to talk about all this. I've got to get these two home to bed, and I'm sure you need to get back to work.
Right, I said.
If you'd like, you could stop by tonight after you're done with work. Brad's out of town, and I usually stay up pretty late.
Sure, I said. She looked pleasantly stumped.
Okay.
She gave me a final smile.
Then I'll see you later.
Later echoed in my brain. I couldn't move my legs until I heard her car pull out of the lot and drive off down the road. I prayed she hadn't seen me in her rearview mirror standing stiffly with my eyes glazed, like the first time I had been combed with a metal detector. Chapter 11. I went straight there. I never even thought about going home first and doing stuff like changing my clothes or brushing my teeth or picking her a bouquet of my mom's daffodils. I showed up in my blue ShopRite shirt and Dad's coat, with my hair sweating beneath my ready-mix cap. I was prepared, though. I kept the art book in my truck, and I studied a couple more pictures under the parking lot lamps before I drove out. I showed up with my head crammed full of impassioned brushwork and bold composition and carefree lines of great verve and fluidity. She answered the door smiling, wearing a short black tank top and drawstring pants that hung low on her hips. I was pretty sure Victoria's Secret would have called them loungewear.
Hi, Harley, she said. Come on in.
The floor inside the door was made of the same polished stones as the kitchen floor. The walls were a varnished gold wood. On a row of black iron hooks hung Esme's backpack, a Tweety Bird umbrella, two little coats, a purse, and a man's flannel shirt.
You want to take off your coat?
No, I said. I mean, yes. I took it off and handed it to her. She hung it next to the shirt. I took off my hat, too, and messed up my hair with my hand so it wouldn't be flat. I wished I could see a mirror, but I reminded myself if she was the type who cared about hairstyles, I would have never made it this far. She turned and walked into the house, calling over her shoulder,
"Do you want a beer?"
"Sure," I said. Her bare feet padded over her stones. I followed her, glancing around me nervously, not fearing the bad, but fearing the good. I felt like I could stand my ground if her husband burst out of the bedroom waving a shotgun at me, or if I found a freezer full of body parts from other boys she had corrupted and then decided to dispose of. But I felt like I would go running screaming from the house if she slipped her fingertips into my pants again. She opened the refrigerator door and leaned into it. I could tell by the way her pants stretched and clung to her ass that she wasn't wearing anything underneath. All of me went stiff, not just my dick. If Francis Bacon could have seen me, he would have painted me standing rock hard and purple-faced in a sideshow tent. He would have called it the Amazing Erection Boy.
Here.
She held out a beer bottle to me. She took one for herself, too, but I already smelled something harder on her breath. So she had to get a little trash to be able to do it with me again. I didn't care. I tried to twist off the cap and it wouldn't come. She giggled at me. She was very trashed. She handed me a bottle opener, a gold one shaped like a stag. His antlers fit over the cap. I like your bottle opener, I said, handing it back to her and cringing at my words.
Thanks, she said.
It belonged to my grandfather. I had lucked out. Instead of sounding like an idiot, I had complimented someone she loved. You never told me what happened to you Saturday night, she said, pausing to sip from her bottle. I was worried about you. You were so upset, and your mouth was bleeding. I fell.
You fell?
Yeah. Everything's all right at home then?
Yeah.
I glanced at the bottle opener sitting on her kitchen counter and thought about my own grandfather and how my dad had blown his chance with him. If he had been honest with him at the end, he might have had some closure. He might have felt like he accomplished something, and then maybe he might have been able to accomplish something else.
No, I said suddenly, my face burning. Everything's not all right at home. Everything sucks at home.
She watched me, not with pity or curiosity or even concern. It took me a moment to figure out what it was, since I had never seen it before. It was respect.
Is there any way I can help? She asked.
You can fuck me again.
I almost didn't get the words out before a sob blocked my throat. She dissolved in front of me behind a blur of tears. I wiped them away with the back of my hand, then I felt the hand being pulled away from me. She placed it on her throat like she wanted me to strangle her. I took my thumb and pressed it against the perfect black freckle in the hollow of her throat. Her hands went under my shirt, and her mouth went to my mouth. Her lips, the weight of her against me, made me drop my beer. The bottle exploded when it hit the stone floor. Glass shards and beer foam sprayed everywhere. I jumped back and held up my hands in front of my face, knowing I was going to get hit, and knowing there was nowhere I could hide. But I had never learned to take my punishment like a man. Not like Misty. She always closed her eyes and tilted her head up like she was waiting for a kiss. I admired her bravery. All those times Dad dragged her off to her room, slamming the door behind him. I never heard her cry or scream.
I'm sorry, I cried.
It's all right, she said.
She took a step toward me. I heard the crunch of glass beneath her feet, but she kept coming. My hands were shaking. I was crying like a baby. I just wanted to go home. She kissed me again. I felt her hands behind my neck and in my hair, and her tongue in my mouth. I thought I was going to be different this time. I wasn't hysterical tonight. I wasn't stupid with need. But it was the same. My hands crawled blindly over her body, trying to hold her, but she kept sliding through my fingers like she was made of oil. I wasn't equipped to deal with the agony of anticipation. I wanted to be inside her. That was all I cared about. If I could be inside her, everything would be all right. I told her so. She led me to the glass-topped table and pulled out a chair. She pushed me down into it, then slipped out of her pants. I was right. There wasn't anything underneath. There wasn't anything under her shirt either. She knelt down on her knees naked between my legs to unzip my fly. The soles of her feet were bloody, like Jody's, from that piece of pipe I had to get rid of. She took me in her hand and climbed on top of me. It hadn't been real, and guided me inside her. Jody's feet were fine. I did even less this time. I didn't do any of the things I had promised myself I would do if I got a second chance. I didn't look at her. I didn't pay attention to her. I didn't care if she enjoyed it. I let her ride me while I held her around the waist and felt all my rage and grief being sucked from me each time she raised and lowered her hips. By the time we finished, she had emptied me of everything, good and bad. When I opened my eyes, I had the swirling galaxy feeling again. She hadn't left me this time, though. She was still sitting on top of me, resting against me, with her head on my shoulder and her breasts against my ShopRite shirt. She kissed my neck, then my lips, and shifted in my lap. I felt myself slip out of her. She studied me like she was going over her notes and was happy with them.
You look like you could sleep for days, she said quietly, and kissed me again. Even in this uncomfortable chair.
She smiled and pulled back, holding me by the shoulders, still clamping my legs between her thighs. I stared dumbly at her body and wondered if I could touch her now without losing my mind. "Come here," she said. She crawled off me and held out a hand. I took it and held it for a moment before I could stand up. She walked out of the kitchen, tiptoeing on the ball of one foot because she had cut her heel on the beer glass. I followed and stood in front of the glass shelves with the jungle room behind them, while she bent over to fluff the pillows on the couch for me. "Lie down," she said, patting the cushions. I didn't move, and she made a funny look with a questioning smile. "Something wrong?" She didn't seem to know she was naked, or if she did, she didn't know she was beautiful. Or if she knew that too, she didn't know being naked and beautiful made her mind-numbing. "Huh? Are you okay? Come here." She sat down on the couch. I went and sat next to her. She pushed me down gently on my back, then turned and started taking off my shoes. I was glad I hadn't worn my boots to work today after getting them wet during my trek through the woods. She probably would have thought they were stupid. Amber was right about them. "Your foot's bleeding," I told her. "I know," she said, glancing down at it. "I need to go put something on it. I need to clean up that mess in the kitchen, too." My fear came rushing back. I started to sit up. "I'm sorry," I said urgently. "It's all right. I'll help you clean it up." "No." She pushed me down again and leaned over to kiss me. I grabbed her and started kissing her back. She pulled away and told me to calm down and slow down. "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm a rotten kisser." "No, you're not. You just need to relax and not think about it." She climbed over me, pushed up on all fours, and bent her head down until our mouths were almost touching. Then she started running her tongue back and forth over my lips. "I'm thinking about it again," I said, swallowing hard. She stopped and gave me a look that was pretty close to the way I thought a woman should look at a guy if he had done a good job. "You need to go to sleep," she told me. "Are you coming back?" "Yes." I watched her limp out of the living room. She left a trail of tiny bright red drops on her gold floor. I wanted to tell her, but I still didn't know what to call her, and I was already falling asleep. She woke me in the morning. Weak gray light filled the room. I looked around trying to figure out where I was. I saw a big stone fireplace and a jungle behind glass shelves holding framed family portraits of somebody else's family. I had slept so deeply I didn't feel like I had slept at all. "Harley." She was hovering over me in the cleanest, fluffiest white bathrobe I had ever seen. I wanted to rub my face in it. I reached for her. "No, Harley." She brushed my hands away. "We can't. I let you sleep too long. Zach's already awake." I woke up a little more. "I'm sorry." She stood up and tugged on my hand. "But you have to go." I hardly recognized her from the night before. She was irritable and all business. I was familiar with mood swings. I had spent my life in a house full of females. But Callie didn't seem to swing as much as she switched. She hurried me to the front door and piled my shoes, my dad's coat, and my hat in my arms. "Chances are Zach wouldn't say anything, but you can never be sure with three-year-olds." "Right. I'm sorry." She sighed and dragged her hand through her hair. "I hate to rush you off like this, like you're some sort of criminal." "It's okay. I don't know when I'll be able to see you again," she went on. "Between the kids and Brad and you working two jobs, I can quit one." She looked up at me. The creases on her forehead were more noticeable in the morning light. Two lines beginning and ending at nowhere. She was standing sort of lopsided. I noticed the end of a band-aid on the outside of her heel. "Very funny," she said, frowning. I was being serious. She sent me off with a promise that she'd call me. I walked to my truck, turning her words over in my head. Savoring them at first, then ripping them apart looking for hidden meaning. I decided to believe her. It was early when I got home. The clock in my truck didn't work, but I figured it was about 6 a.m. I had left Jody and Misty alone all night. Amber had gone out. She was right about me being paranoid. If Jody and Misty could stay by themselves during the day, they could do it at night, too. Betty had been right, too, saying I was using it as an excuse to avoid visiting Skip. Maybe I would go visit Skip after all, I thought to myself as I crossed the yard. Maybe I could get Callie to come, too. The idea was brilliant, so brilliant I had to stop and take a seat.